won't accept that this is how it's gonna be.
Hey everybody, we're back. It's Eric Mann with co-host Damon Azali. We're very happy to have in studio the mellifluous Jim Lafferty, great host of KPFK's own National Lawyers Guild show, and a real expert on national security from the point of view of those of us being oppressed by it. Jim's represented a lot of grassroots groups. From the Democratic Convention struggle in 2000 to the Republican RNC in 2004. So he sees often the national security state, not just in the abstract, but of actual people trying to exercise their constitutional rights and being denied. So, Jim, why don't we start with, it's almost hard to track the different numbers of terror against the Constitutional Rights Acts, but let's explain to us and update us about the Patriot Act. I heard it's being extended, but not completely extended. I'm having trouble just following the zigs and zags of the congressional debate. Why don't you explain its status and some of its most onerous provisions that we should be worried about?
And good afternoon, Eric and Damon. Thanks for inviting me here. It's been extended for about 4 or 5 weeks. That's running out now. Congress, going back in session, will now have to take it up again. Where we left off when Congress recessed was that the House had passed one version of renewing the Patriot Act, the Senate another version, and they differed. The first point I would like to make is that the difference between the House version, though, and the Senate version is not as dramatic as I think most of us have been led to believe by the mainstream media. There are differences between the two. Certainly, if my only choice is to have the Senate version and the Republican version, I take the Senate version. But it's awful law. It's a repressive law. And it doesn't fundamentally change the House version. It's tinkering at best. In some cases, some of the most onerous provisions would sunset again a little quicker in the Senate version than they would in the House version. Or in some cases, some of the provisions in the Senate that are most onerous would allow for some appeal, not a particularly meaningful appeal, but at least on paper there'd be the appearance of some sort of an appeal from something that the government may have done to you that's not in the House version. But
if you're on the bus and you're talking to some bus riders, tell them the three worst things that are going to pass in either version right now.
Yeah. First of all, your phone conversations can be listened to under either versions and monitored. If you get off the bus and go to the public library, if the FBI decides they want to know what you are reading, maybe you're active in the Bus Riders Union, and they want to know what you've been checking out from the library, under either version, they can do that. Under either version, initially, the librarian is not allowed to tell you they've even been in to check your reading records. Mm. If you go home and you have a computer and you want to go online and you want to communicate your ideas online, maybe you want to check certain websites that the government thinks are problematic websites. That's something that can be done as well. Maybe while you're on that bus, and this is one of the most onerous things, your house can be searched under either version of this act without you being told about it in advance. That is, the government can get a sneak and peek warrant, that's what it's popularly known as, go into your house while you're off on your way to work or at work, search your house, leave, and not ever having not only shown you the warrant, not even telling you that you're there, that they were there.
And then bring you up on charges.
And then bring you up on
based
charges.
Based on evidence that they found.
Exactly. Or alleged to have found. You don't know. You weren't there to watch
exactly
the search.
Exactly right.
For all you know, they planted the evidence
exactly
or found it
right.
Somebody else. So neither one of these versions is what we would expect in a free society. They're both products of the fear in the country post 9/11. And they go hand in hand with what we're also seeing happen with respect to the national security state in a broader sense. The high-profile issue at the moment, of course, being George Bush's contention, made several times now on radio and television, that because Congress authorized him to wage war in Afghanistan, Iraq, the so-called war on terror, that he therefore has the right to issue wiretap warrants, rather, for American citizens and residents' phone conversations with other American citizens and residents without doing what the National Security Act requires him and everybody else to do, and that is go to what's called the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, and get a warrant to do that so that there's some judge to say, hey, wait a minute, what do you want to tap Eric Mann's phone for? Well, you got to show me something.
You're giving him my name over the phone? Thanks a lot. They already have it.
They got it, Eric. Believe me, Damon and you guys have got it. Now, it's all well and good to say that the FISA court never saw a warrant request that they didn't like.
Right.
Nevertheless, the notion that the president, as an imperial president, can in time of war, and mind you, this is the so-called war on terrorism that can go on for 40, 50, 60 years.
Right.
So the notion that somehow he now has the right, despite the fact that it's a federal felony, 5 years imprisonment, to do that, has alarmed a lot of people. I noticed even today during the hearings at the Senate Judiciary Committee on the confirmation of Judge Alito to the Supreme Court, one of the more conservative members of that panel, Senator Lindsey Graham, voiced the concern that with that kind of interpretation, that an act of Congress that gives the president the right to go to war frees him from the obligation to abide by any other restrictions under the law, might make it hard for Congress in the future to be willing to grant those kinds of war-making powers, which, of course, Lindsey Graham, you and I might feel that's fine, but Graham does not feel that's fine. So you've got that going on at the same time. And then, less noticed, but just as important in many ways, you've got a renewal of infiltration of political groups by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And you and I know, because we have files to prove it, that during the 70s, the FBI infiltrated anti-war groups, pro-workers' rights groups, immigrant rights groups, women's groups, and the like, and kept dossiers on people. And more than that, infiltrated for the purpose of creating mischief, for the purpose of perhaps sending that group off on an illegal pursuit. They were government provocateurs. That was supposed to have been ended. But that is all back now, post-Patriot Act, post-9/11. So that's a danger we have to be aware of as well.
So, Jim, one of the questions I have is, all the stuff that's happening in terms of Bush trying to consolidate his power, is that building off the Patriot Act, or is it actually him thinking and the administration thinking that the Patriot Act's about to sunset and not be there, and this is kind of another wave of that activity?
Yeah, I really don't think it's either, David. Both the Patriot Act and the FBI's renewed spying, and what we haven't talked about yet, the Department of Defense spying, these are all products of 9/11. And the Patriot Act itself is a product of 9/11. You instill enough fear in people and you can get the Congress, who hadn't even read the damn thing, to pass any act you want. Or the president hopes to forgive him if he violates the law and taps your phone call. So these are all part and parcel, along with certain other executive orders on his efforts to detain people, including American citizens indefinitely, all part and parcel of the same package.
Let me ask you something. I mean, one of the dynamics with a lot of our listeners is they would agree with everything you're saying. They already have a predisposition towards a national security state. But what is the opposition to any one thing? Who has raised, like you said about Lindsey Graham, are there any, during the presidential election, George Bush kept saying we're at war.
Mm-hmm.
John Kerry could never challenge it and say, no, we're not at war.
Mm-hmm.
He kept saying, well, we are at war, but your war is too big, or you fought the wrong war. I would go to Afghanistan, not with Iraq. So both parties, with Bush taking the lead, asserted that we are at war. And it seemed, and as he said, a war against everyone for all time.
Mm-hmm.
So where is any level besides Murtha on the actual Iraq? Are there any comparable? I heard Feingold is pretty good. Is there a unified block of any democratic liberals, trying to provide coherent civil liberties opposition to the death, to the Patriot Act?
If I had to give a one-word answer, I would say no. That would be a little unfair. There's certainly nothing that you would expect from an opposition party in any kind of true democracy.
Right.
Now, you certainly do have some Democrats, and you have some Republicans. You have people like former Congressman Bob Barr joining with the American Civil Liberties Union and other civil liberties groups in opposing this imperial president. It's imposing a Patriot Act and all this other kind of spying. So there certainly are some true conservatives who, along with a handful of liberals, are concerned about all this. But I think it's seen to be such you risk being accused of not wanting to defend the country when we're at war. And that's what I think is holding back. Even when public opinion polls show more and more people don't even support the war, there seems to be a great deal of timidness, if you will, on the part of our opposition party to raise the specter. It took somebody like Murtha to do it. Remember John Kerry that you mentioned during the last presidential debate wanted to send more troops to Iraq, for that matter. So there isn't that kind of organized, strong opposition. That's why I say it manifests in this difference between the Senate version and the Republican version of the Patriot Act. But when you really examine them from a civil liberties point of view, yes, one's a bit better, but neither are what we should have in a free society. That's about as strong as the opposition gets within the Congress itself.
One of the interesting things I've been thinking about, the right wing has at least either thinks out their strategy better than the left, or it just maybe has it actually working. So I see in terms of the judicial system, they're trying to stack the courts on one level. Secondly, there's this kind of wave after wave of anti-immigrant, anti-woman, anti-gay, anti-black legislation that they're throwing out. So you had Proposition 73 in the last election trying to ban abortion. They're bringing that back. They've been talking about bringing 187 back, Prop 54 back. So it's kind of thinking like they're already the second in the courts, and then they're trying to change the rules on the ground. So it seems like it's still a pretty unstoppable force. I mean, we've won some elections here and there. I guess my question to you is, based on all the kind of chips in the Bush administration's armor, you mentioned basically stuff that he was guilty of possibly having impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the chances are of that actually happening and actually a force coming and mounting that?
Well, not much, I must confess. Representative John Conyers from Detroit, my hometown, has started a movement towards censure off of some of this National Security Act stuff that could lead to impeachment, an impeachment process. But the notion that somehow Republican-controlled Congress is going to impeach this president, I think, is wishful thinking in the extreme. I think part of the problem is that you can't beat something with nothing. And if you've got on the one side a core of corporate America and religious fanatics and what have you on the right pushing their agenda with a lot of big bucks to do it, and you don't have an equal force on the left because you don't have that in the opposition party, you don't have that in the Democratic Party, it's not a very equal contest. For whatever differences there may be between the Democrats and the Republicans, they're both capitalists. They both want essentially the same system. They're both imperialist parties. They both want to make sure that U.S. markets grow all over the world, and they care less. I mean, one of them may care a little more about the workers' rights in Mexico than somebody else, but not much. So when you've got that kind of unanimity, if you will, in the Congress and in the powerful halls of corporate America, it makes it very difficult, it seems to me. I think to the extent that people begin to weed themselves away from that process, as people are doing, I think the fact that less and less people vote today is a helpful sign when they see that there is nothing really between the two that they should vote for. To the extent that they organize the way I know some of you fellows have done through the Bus Riders Union or what have you, people taking, if you will, their future into their own hands and getting into the streets with it and doing organizing work, whether it's around the war, whether it's women's issues, whether it's economic issues for people who ride the buses, I think there's a lot more to be gained that way than to look to some sort of opposition, organized establishment opposition force to the organized establishment right-wing force that is hell-bent on taking the country backwards.
Except where I don't agree with that, Jim, is that I don't think that's a helpful counterposition. I mean, my whole life has been spent primarily building the so-called counterforce on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But contradictions, whether it's a contradiction between Richard Reardon, who was far more progressive than, of all things, Richard Alatorre, or hoping for Antonio Villaraigosa on a specific issue to be able to not do our job but be open to us, or a John Murtha breaking out of the pack, who's a conservative Democrat, we, as we're trying to build the movement on the ground, have to ask ourselves why we don't have an effective third party, why we couldn't run...
Oh, absolutely.
Why we can't run somebody for mayor and get 15% of the vote in this country, or run somebody for senator and get 8 to 10%.
Absolutely.
So both must be built simultaneously.
Oh, no. I don't want to be misunderstood. So, I agree with that completely.
So we're looking for allies.
Yes.
And I agree with your analysis, except tactically, it can lead to an abstentionist view that it doesn't matter. So, for instance, what I'm looking for, and I don't have the research, so that's why I'm asking you, is there is a history of ironically conservatives often feeling more able to fight the Cold War. So you have Senator Byrd from West Virginia, a racist, a reactionary, I believe Democrat,
mm-hmm.
writing an amazing statement about the decline of U.S. civilization in going to Iraq.
Yes.
You have Murtha, who's covered with war medals,
yes.
who feels able. You have McCain able to raise certain concerns about
the torture issue
because his bona fides in Vietnam are unquestionable. You think, and I'm a leftist. You seem to have no one on the left, forget the left, no liberal, willing to say, I want to lead this and be attacked as a liberal.
Yeah.
So my question is, if I was going to do the roll call, are there any people in the Senate, even if it's six of them,
mm-hmm.
leading any opposition to this? Because if our listeners are asking now what
mm-hmm.
to do,
mm-hmm.
they can't say, call Peter Camejo.
Mm-hmm.
Or call the bus riders union. Mm-hmm. Or they have to say, is there anybody on any committee
that we
could talk to?
Yeah, well, sure. I mean,
yes,
I
you should call me, and,
yes.
and you should call Peter Camejo,
yes,
you should call whoever you want. But you should also have to, even when we call us, we're going to say, who do we know in Congress that is a tactical ally in this situation?
Oh, sure. I don't want to be misunderstood on that. You use whatever allies you can as you're trying to build, for example, that third party that you talk about. I was just answering really Damon's question as to why we're in the state of affairs we are today in the political process, in the insider political process. But sure, you use a Murtha, you use a Feingold, you use a Kennedy on the Judiciary Committee who had the sharpest comments today. You make sure that you lobby Senator Feinstein because one can never be quite sure what her vote is, although you would think that she's going to be an ally on this battle against Alito getting confirmed. You press as there's a huge women's coalition today that has at least 200 people on the ground as we speak in Washington lobbying every member of the Senate on the Alito.
Asking for a no vote.
Asking for a no vote and asking if necessary for a filibuster.
Let's take a minute there.
Yeah.
We're now segueing. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. This mm-hmm. is Jim Lafferty of the National Lawyers Guild, Damon Azzali and myself from the Strategy Center and also mainly from Voices from the Frontlines. What we're trying to do, the common theme of this conversation is, given that the right is moving on so many fronts, are there any openings? So Alito is now coming up. You heard his opener today.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just a nice Italian immigrant.
Yes.
But notice he said, I came to consciousness with those disruptive leftists of the 60s.
That's right.
And that made me really believe in the rule of law.
Yes.
Okay. Now, tell us more about his actual voting positions on abortion rights now. Because you know how they portray it. I'm a totally open-minded person, mm-hmm. and anything I wrote before has nothing to do with how I'm going to vote in the
mm-hmm.
future.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah.
And if you know, what is the Democratic Party's response to the which may be the swing vote on Roe versus Wade?
Yeah. Well, he's made it very clear in his writings, but also in his rulings as a judge on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, where he stands on the issue of abortion. He's told us in no uncertain terms that
That's
he
right.
thinks it was wrongly decided. And while he was on the Third Circuit, the Casey, Pennsylvania decision is a prime example. The need to have notification before a woman can get an abortion, he was all for that. In fact, one of the writings that hasn't been talked about as much is he said it may be difficult to overturn Roe versus Wade, and therefore he said the strategy should be to erode it as much as possible by putting barriers in the way of a woman having an abortion. And if you look at his record, he's authored some 350 opinions of his own. He's been part of thousands of opinions from the Third Circuit in 15 years. You see that take place. Somebody did a statistical study in terms of civil rights cases in general. In 75% of the civil rights cases that came before him, he voted against the person claiming racial discrimination, claiming sexual harassment, claiming the failure to get an appointment because the plaintiff was a woman. So it isn't just even in the area of abortion that he is has a very right-wing position on civil rights, civil liberties. The other interesting thing about the very statement that you referenced today, when he was at Princeton and why he was so upset about the rabble in the street, which of course was the anti-Vietnam War movement,
That's right.
He didn't speak about that as that was then and this is now. One got the impression that not only formed his thinking then, but that's why he's who he is today, because the whole theme of his speech was how he got here today.
That's
he started
correct.
Off with that joke about the Baltimore Railroad.
A terrible joke.
Yeah, terrible joke, I might add. Not even funny.
That's right.
And also, he didn't bother, of course, to talk about the clubs he joined at Princeton, the job of which of the club was to keep women and people of color from even going to Princeton.
Right.
So he's been reversed virtually more than any other judge in the Third Circuit, which is not a radical, it's not the Ninth Circuit, it's not a liberal circuit at all. So he has a documented history right up till the present time of being against what we think of, and what Kennedy spoke about very eloquently today, is that as did Leahy and some others, of that kind of notion that there are individual rights in this country that the government can't take away from you. He's rather made his life commitment to keeping those individual rights as curtailed as possible, making the executive branch of the government the strongest branch. It is a very imperial view of the presidency and of what the Constitution calls for, I think. I don't know if that's
very good. That's absolutely very helpful, especially, like, you know, as you said, a third court of appeals being reversed by a very conservative. It missed me that he didn't even
meet their standards.
Right, didn't even meet their pretend.
And has been criticized by his justices, fellow justices on the Third Circuit, as being out of the mainstream. And that court finds him out of the mainstream. And if you're a lawyer and if you study these things, you know that if you're out of the mainstream on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, you're out of the mainstream.
So the question again would come to, what do we do?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a more organized, I mean, one of the most elementary things is it takes a Democrat. I mean, I actually heard Hillary Clinton say on the, is it John Roberts?
Yes.
The John Roberts.
It was John Roberts, yes.
Confirmation, mm-hmm. She voted against him. Is
yes.
that correct?
Yes.
She said, I'm sorry, you're no good on civil rights, you're mm-hmm. no good on voting rights, you're no good on women's rights.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'm no big fan of Hillary Clinton, mm-hmm. we'll do a whole no show on her, but to say those three words, mm-hmm. voting rights, civil rights, and women's mm-hmm. rights, it's hard getting Democrats to even say that. So it's very hard to find. Another article I read this weekend said the Democrats are so helpful about the corruption scandal because it won't force them to talk about any other issue. What are they going to run on? Elect me and I won't steal as much.
You know? That's right, man. That's
so
right.
They, my question back to you is, you said there's the women's groups are in Washington,
yes.
that Kennedy's played a good role. How much organized opposition is there to Alito, and what, if people feel that it's appropriate to oppose him, are there vehicles for people's participation?
Yeah, if you give me a second here as I'm rustling through my papers to the annoyance of our engineer, I'll actually find a list of, I think, some events that are coming up right here in Los Angeles that people can be involved in. Oops, here we go. Here's a couple of them right here, I think. But one of the things that's important to note, too, is that you have a weakened president.
That's right.
And you have a weakened Republican Congress because over 200 of them have so far had to give back money that they got through the Abramoff scandal, most of those Republicans. You've got a lame duck president. You would think that it wouldn't be that much of a reach for the Democrats now to filibuster if they have to. And there's been some talk of that. But at any rate, there's we missed the one today. Today's already January 9th. I guess let me just see if there's any events coming up. I think they all happen today, the ones I know about. But you can get in touch with the No on Alito campaign, and you can get in touch with them by calling 323-223-4462. That's 323-223-4462, and I guess you ask if you want to make it quicker for you for extension 3218, because there is a group. Susan Lerner, for example, from the Committee for Judicial Independence, is doing a lot of work on this area. And in that regard, you can go to their website. If you go to www.independentjudiciary, all one word, www.independentjudiciary.org, you can find out all sorts of ways to most effectively do your lobbying, most effectively talk to the members of the Senate, join rallies and press conferences and other events that are aimed at stopping this particular nomination. Because Sandra Day O'Connor wants the swing vote. This will push the court far, far to the right. not at a time when the country is already on the brink of great division. So I think that's one reason why we're all hoping that we can find enough, they can find enough backbone in Congress, if you will, and in the Senate, if you will, to stop it.
So you have been listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, Eric Mann and Damon Azali with Jim Lafferty. And we're going to go to a short break and be right back with Renee Salcedo.